once more onto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Welcome back to another second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach starring Jake McClure. If you'd like to call in today, I don't know that I even gave the phone numbers last hour, but if you'd like to call in today, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400, and I would love to talk to you. I've been doing this a long time with my partner and my father. I started working with him back in 1991. So this year is my 25th year working with him, and it's been fantastic. I've learned a lot, and working with a father for that period of time is one of those things that most people would consider a nightmare. We have worked out very well. We have become best friends over those years, and so father-son relationship has slowly become more brotherly, and to the point where the old relationship went from when I was a child doesn't exist in the same way. But I still have some pretty big pangs when he's not doing well. So he's in the middle of recovering. He's doing better every day. Keep him in your minds. If you're of that mindset, pray for him. I'm sure he'll appreciate it. Thank you. All right, and now on to the rest of what I had to talk about. A couple of years ago, not that long ago, just a couple of years ago, the biggest piece of news that anybody was talking about was the Greek tragedy, the Greek exit from the Eurozone, the Grexit. And people were utterly concerned about it. It's a scary situation. The Greeks are bankrupt, and how are they going to do it? And we have all these different huge bodies giving them money to in loans to see if they can somehow turn it around. Well, they haven't turned it around. But let me kind of give you some of the nature. I hit on this last week about how we are so often afraid of the wrong things. This coming week, the end of this week, the next big tranche of money is going to be paid to the Greeks if they meet 14 different steps that they had to meet since about a year ago. This is big deal. I mean, not really a big deal to us. We don't really even know about it here in the United States because it's not been reported. I mean, it's reported tiny. It's in the back pages. Of those 14 steps, they have completed one. They've got to complete the other 13 that was supposed to take all year in the next week. They say they can do it. But this is the sort of thing that 2 years ago would have caused a panic. It would have caused everyone to look around and say, what could this mean? How is this going to affect us? The European Union's going to fall apart. It's not even an event. It's not reported. Nobody is caring about it. The Greeks are still a basket case. Their economy has not done well. Their tax revenue is not good. But they've been in the same place for long enough that we don't care. Now, I do expect some of those headlines if there's a slow news day. I expect some of those headlines this coming week. If there's not a slow news day, then don't expect it. But if there's a slow news day, one day where Hillary Clinton isn't coughing in a speech or Donald Trump isn't calling somebody a name, I don't think that that's going to happen. But those are the scandals. Things pop up. People get upset. They make it a big news thing. If none of that happens, if we have one day, then we'll have a headline somewhere that's going to sound ultra terrifying. The Greeks may not, blah, 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 blah. The same thing we've heard for years and years and years. The reality is that the Europeans have a big problem, but it's the same big problem that they've had for about 15 years, way before the recession. The problem is that they don't have a constitution. They don't have a rule book that governs how they do business with each other. This is part of the reason at the end of last hour we were talking about the money sitting in Ireland, the lawsuit that the European Union is throwing at the company, Apple. And the Irish and the company Apple are together defending the actions that took place. Tim Cook said it was political hogwash. Well, that's all taxes are. So there's still a reality. Political or not, that's how politics get paid. We have a system in the United States that at least addresses how we pay taxes in our individual states. That's the Constitution. It says that the government of the United States, the federal government, gets to regulate the trade that takes place across state lines. And if you live in the United States, you have to pay taxes to the United States if you make money. And in the case of Obamacare, even if you don't make money, but you don't have health insurance, then you owe the tax. So in the European Union, that doesn't exist. There's nobody really in charge. There's some people that are sort of in charge, but they don't have a lot of law behind them in regulating the trade between the countries there. So it's mostly done in a court system where the courts kind of make the decisions as they go along based on what they think the law should be rather than what it really is, because they haven't decided on a constitution. This is a big problem. The Brexit, the Britain exit from the European Union. People are still kind of wondering, is that actually going to happen? What's going to go? What do we expect here? I mean, it's not in the news all of a sudden, and sometimes it's back in the news, but nobody's saying what date or any of that. In effect, what's happened here is the United Kingdom has signed the divorce papers, but there's no court system that knows how to process them. If you think about that for a second, you know that there's a big issue. There's a really big issue. Their regulatory arena is far more complex than ours. As bad as ours is, and I talk about that on a regular basis, we have a way too onerous a system of regulations on businesses and on taxes. Theirs is worse, lots worse. And they have no single entity that's regulating them. It's by votes in a European Parliament in Brussels every couple of years to see how it should be done at any given moment. And if it's a big enough trade differential, then any country, any single country in the European Union can veto it. That'd be kind of like Delaware being able to veto Texas's sales tax if it were being applied to people living in Delaware. They don't get that right. If you're buying something in Texas from Texans, Delaware doesn't get to say you can't do that because it's in Texas. It's not that clear in the European Union. What does that mean to us? It's a convoluted, nasty system. The Greeks have still 13. They're called prior actions to be completed over the next week. What does that mean? United Kingdom is leaving the European Union. What does that mean? It means that they're going to continue to be a basket case in Europe for quite some time. Don't expect them to be the engine that's driving the world economically anytime in the near future. They can't even figure out how to drive their own engines right now. They're not, much less drive the entire world. The United States is doing that. China is participating, but they're participating in a way that is absurd. I mentioned this last week. They're the five biggest banks in the world. Speaking of concepts from the recession, the too big to fail mentality. The five biggest banks in the world are all Chinese banks, all five of them. And you think about our economy is still bigger than the Chinese economy by a large amount. If the five biggest banks in the world, and that's not by customer, it's by deposit, by how much money they have. The five biggest banks in the world are in China. They're all state-owned. This is still a communist country, China, not the United States. If China is still a communist country, they're supporting these banks, and 19% of their loans outstanding are non-performing. What does that mean? We just got into jargon again. It means people aren't making their payments on 19% of those loans for five of the largest banks in the world. And the reality is because those banks are making loans to big corporations that aren't making profits. But the loans are there because the Chinese government is working really hard on making it look like their economy is growing really fast. They're working really hard. The Chinese government is working really hard in making sure everybody has a job, whether they need it or not. That's still a communist mentality. If everybody has a job, whether they need it or not, what does that mean? Everybody needs a job. Well, not if they're not doing their job. Not if they can't perform and pay the debt that caused the job to exist. That job needs to go away. I mean, anybody who's been around any business, and I think the vast majority of the people that listen to this program are at least business-mindsetted. If you have an employee or you are an employee that's not doing your job, what do? Well, hopefully if you're honorable and you're an employee that's not able to do your own job, you either work really hard at figuring out how to do it or you quit. And if you're the employer, if you've got an employee that you like a lot but is completely incompetent in their job, you either need to move them to a new position or sadly let them go. Because the purpose of business is not to give jobs. The purpose of business is to make a profit. And the people that have the jobs benefit from the profit of the business. If you can't make a profit, then you don't need the job. That's what I mean, need it or not. So China is a basket case to some extent as well. That leaves us. We're a basket case. We're just nowhere near as bad as the rest of the world. That's something that people need to hold on to. The concepts in this election, both sides are talking as if America is somehow a tarnished entity, that we're not as wonderful as we once were in some way. And the reality is that we're greater now than we ever have been. We're not doing great as far as our foreign policy is concerned, as far as whether we make good decisions in the leadership roles of the government. But we're doing fantastically on the economic front. We are doing far better than the rest of the world. And that's something we need to keep in mind. And that's with a lot of stuff holding us back. Our regulatory system needs to be fixed. There's a great example of this right now. The Chinese companies, and I'm going to use a specific example, though I'm not going to try to pronounce the name of the company. In English, it's got five syllables, and none of the syllables are pronounceable using our normal sounds. So our normal phonetics doesn't work here, and rather than mangle it, I'm just going to say a large Chinese company in the business of refining aluminum. Now, aluminum is a very interesting metal. Let's give this little background a little bit. Aluminum used to be the most valuable metal on the planet. It was a very valuable thing because the refining technique for it is very difficult until you have electricity. Before electricity, the only aluminum that existed was that which formed naturally through lightning strikes. You've got mineral bauxite. There's other minerals that have aluminum in them. You put it through a pretty massive electric charge. This is simplified to the extreme. And out comes aluminum. Aluminum now is one of the cheapest metals. It's something that we throw away without regard. Now people say, recycle your cans. But people throw it away all the time. We throw away steel. We throw away aluminum. It's cheap enough that we don't have to collect it and melt it down in our backyards. This is a great luxury. Okay. Here's one of the issues that's a problem in trade based on aluminum. There's a Chinese company who has been refining aluminum for quite some time. They've refined a lot of aluminum. And by a lot, I mean $2 billion worth with a B. They shipped it to Mexico. Now, the difference between refining in China and refining in the United States, Alcoa just shut down a plant that was an aluminum refinery. The difference is that in China, the electricity bill is subsidized by the government because it's a communist company. It's partially state-owned. Most of their companies are. If the biggest expense in the refining process is the cost of electricity, then their prices are lower than they should be. It's kind of like having a benefit given to the company before they export. It's not fair. It's not cool. And when it comes to trade policies, that's the sort of thing that the World Bank and all of the inter-country regulatory agreements say you can't do that. Well, this company just got the SmackDown put on it, because they moved $2 billion of aluminum, subsidized aluminum. As far as we can tell, the Chinese government had nothing to do with it, except that it's a state, semi-state-owned company, just like all of them. They moved this big chunk of aluminum over a multi-year period into Mexico so that they could ship it up using free trade with Mexico as if the Mexicans owned it. Well, they got caught because the American companies know what their competitors are doing. And if the price drops drastically in a thing and the prices to create the thing haven't dropped, they look around and they say, wait a minute, our technology is better than the Chinese when it comes to this. We're better at this. How come they have the ability to make it at a lower price? And they don't. So that $2 billion of aluminum is being confiscated. It will eventually partially be released back to the Chinese company, but that company is going to be treated harshly by the Chinese government as well. Trade issues are really important, and aluminum prices dropping, they've been dropping. Part of the reason why they're dropping is the Chinese are into aluminum refining now, and they have subsidized electric payments. The only way to make that trade fair is to have a trade agreement. We don't have that kind of trade agreement with China. We have them at most favored nation status. I'm talking about trade a lot because there's such a big misconception on that front. There's so many people that have the wrong opinion on what trade is. Let's just give us, this is a good day to talk about it. Today's September 10th. In 1989, on September 10th, the Berlin Wall started coming down. 89, man, think of that. We're 27 years out from it. That's pretty fascinating. 27 years ago, the Berlin Wall started coming down. Why did it come down? Because of trade. Because the Soviets started opening their trade corridors. The Soviets allowed the Western goods to start being traded in the Soviet Union. As soon as that happened, as soon as the barriers to trade started coming down, and I think most of my listeners remember this dialogue from the time, our system of trading, our system of selling and buying, for the selling things that people really want at prices they want them, in a way that both sides win, it's kind of the basis of what we do. So the idea of opening up trade barriers so that we can get into a country and trade on an equal footing, that's something that we've been pushing since the beginning of the United States and pre. The Boston Tea Party was about a tariff. That concept needs to be applied now. It's totally ironic to me that the Tea Partiers are in support of Donald Trump, who wants to put tariffs on trades, which is what the original Tea Party was against. That, to me, is the biggest irony. It makes me laugh. And not that I'm in any way saying that Hillary Clinton has better trade concepts right now, because she doesn't. She's backed off on all of her free trade areas. So I'm not choosing and picking and choosing a good candidate over a bad candidate here. I'm just saying there are some problems in trade. This is why I'm talking about it. Because it's always a good soundbite to say the Chinese over there are undercutting our products with their prices, so we should put a penalty on them when they bring their goods here. We'll make it more expensive. Well, who pays that penalty? Well, obviously the Chinese companies. No. If we're buying the goods, those Chinese companies just raise the price. Well, isn't that supposed to make it more competitive with American goods? No, unfortunately. That's kind of the best case scenario, but unfortunately it's not the case. Most of the time, the goods that we're buying from China are not goods that are even made in the United States. They're just simply not made here. I mean, you don't have a flat-screen television that's made in the United States. Why? Because it may be made by an American company, but it's made somewhere else because we don't need the brain power that America has developed to put the parts together. We've been retraining ourselves continually for a long time to get better and better at this. Most of the people that put those parts together are completely illiterate. They don't know how to read. We can't compete with a high school educated person who is capable of looking at a computer and knowing what it says. These are people that have been working in rice paddies that maybe have a second grade education. We can't compete with that. Making the prices higher doesn't make us say, all right, we'll take our literate people and have them put these parts together. It says, let's use a robot to do that because it's easier. The concept of free trade is one of the strengths of America. If we can get true free trade with China, we're going to be winding up making more money off of China than they make off of us. That's something that we've seen with Mexico. It's something that we've seen with Canada. Robert Reich, who's a very clear Democrat, is very anti-free trade. He says that the reality of it is that economists aren't looking at the individual. They're looking at the overall economy when they say free trade is good. To some extent, he's true. It's completely correct. And that if you lost a job because somebody overseas was able to make the part cheaper, it doesn't make you feel good to have me say, hey, free trade is good. But you're smarter than that job. If you're listening to this program, this is your pep talk. You're smarter than that job. If an illiterate person in China could take it on and do it cheaper, you need to find a better job. The fact that you had a good wage from it is purely from the fact that you didn't have competition. Competition is one of our strengths. It's the whole difference between capitalism and communism. Yes, it is difficult if somebody outcompetes you. This is why we play sports as kids, because you lose games. You don't stop playing. You get up and you play again. You get better at what you do and you do it again. That's what we're trying to teach our kids. If instead we say, you guys aren't allowed to play us anymore because you outcompeted us, we're never going to get better. Everybody's going to outcompete us. This is what free trade is. We have an open playing field where we all have the same rules. When somebody says, I'm going to make it more fair for America, what that really means, if we have a fair trading agreement, is that we're going to make it more unfair for someone else. We're going to give them a handicap because we can't compete. All they do is turn around and give us a handicap. That means that we just start a trade war where we're tacking higher and higher prices onto everything. The companies that are doing this start failing, but only after the consumers, the you and the me, have to pay more for items and we just decide not to buy them. So we have less than we did before, which means if we have less, where are these items from China being sold? They're being sold in American companies. So those American companies that are selling Chinese goods, whether it be Walmart or Best Buy or Sam's, or you go down the list of basically everybody out there, those companies start to fail. Their profits go down because the prices went up on things that we expect prices to go down on. If you think of a big screen TV, most people wait till the Christmas season or just after to buy a new big screen TV because we expect the prices to go down. Well, if the prices instead suddenly go way up and we wait to get it, the prices keep going up because less people are buying them and the tariff still has to be paid. It gets paid when it comes into the country. That means that has to be recuperated. I'm banging on this subject because there is so much ignorance in the political world on what trade is. If you own a company and you're selling things to another country or another state, and suddenly that state has a company that's doing the same thing you are, and they're able to compete with you, well, you may find better ways of doing business. How do I bring the cost down? If there's an unfair playing field, if they're allowed to get subsidies to do something, then you can appeal to your state and say, hey, can we get subsidies too? And you say, well, the state doesn't agree with that. Then you can go to the other state and say, this doesn't make sense. Our political structure says that our state goes to their state, through the court system and the federal world and says, hey, you're not playing on an equal playing field. When we have a free trade agreement, the reason why those things are so thick is because it's covering that sort of deal where if they somehow get subsidized and sell to us, it's not fair anymore. So we have recourse. NAFTA has a tribunal. The head of the tribunal is always an American. That's who settles the dispute for NAFTA. People talk about NAFTA being a horrible thing. They're only saying that recently, by the way. The reality is that we have created more jobs in the United States through NAFTA by far than we lost. Now, if you lost a job for NAFTA, it doesn't make you feel good that somebody else got one. But if you got a job, you may not even know you got it because of NAFTA. The reason why General Motors was able to stay in business as long as it was, with the kind of drag it had by paying union contracts for people that didn't even work there anymore, they were retired, they were getting huge amounts of money from General Motors, and I've used this figure before, I'll use it again, a third of the cost of the car was paid on the car before the car was even started because it went to retirees, health benefits and retirement plans. How do you compete if a third of your price is something that isn't in the car? We were able to continue to compete because we were able to get the parts for cheaper in Mexico. How many people in General Motors lost their job because Mexico started making the parts? Just about zero. They made jobs at General Motors, and a lot of the parts manufacturers made jobs too because they moved on to higher tech parts. They're the reasons why airbags work and that we have computers in the car because it started in America. The innovation is what we're good at. Don't put us at monkey work. Don't make us do the same thing over and over and over and over and over again. That's the recipe for insanity in the United States. Free trade is so important. If California said any goods made in Texas are going to have a 10% tariff put on them, first, the federal government would say that's illegal. But let's say, all right, you're allowed to do that, California. Well, what's Texas going to do? Well, our immediate response is, okay, California, if you're going to do that to us, we're going to do that to you. Who benefits? Well, the governments do at the beginning because they get to collect that tariff and it starts to pad their pockets. They get to spend on things. Now, are they going to pay down the debt? Probably not. They're probably going to spend on new things. But it slows down the trade. And who pays the tax? Well, the Californians pay the tax on the tariff that's put on Texas goods. They have to pay 10% more. It goes to their own government. So it's a new tax on their own citizens. If we put a tariff on Mexico, United States gets to pay governmental taxes. We get to pay more taxes. Think about that for a minute. That's the reality of a tariff. Because those corporations just raise their prices. They're not going to say, I'm going to lower my prices because of the tariff. That's not how profits work. They want to keep their same profit margin, particularly if they're already really low price and there's no competitors. If they're a Chinese company making ball bearings or computer parts, and we suddenly have a 30% tariff on it, they raise their prices by that much. And we have to pay it because nobody else makes the stuff. If we want to compete in those areas, we can make the manufacturing facility, but that takes a lot of money up front. And I've already mentioned that the regulatory environment is not great for starting new businesses. It's hard to start a new business. So I have covered that. We've got to play some commercials. I've been on the same subject. I wanted to do kind of a theme this time around, and I'm glad that I did. I've got to play some commercials, and I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure. If you'd like to join us for the conversation, the phone number in here is 254-773-1400. All right. Next subject. I want to say again, we don't endorse the commercials and sometimes are anti-endorsement on the commercials. Just keep that in mind. When someone offers you guaranteed income when everybody else is losing money and it's double digit, just know that you don't make money without risk. It's not possible. That's a very important piece to know. I mean, you can make money without risk if your parents give you money. When you're talking about dealing with a company, that's not the way it works. Keep that in mind. All right. So, I wanted to talk about Wells Fargo. Wells Fargo, who made it through the Great Recession along with Bank of America with a relatively clean bill of sale. They came through that thing with good market practices. They had good ethics at the time when everybody else in the big banking world was doing things that were murky and nasty and may not have had a law directly against it at the time, but that was not cool. Wells Fargo just got hit with a big fine. I want to talk about that. They have fired about 5,300 employees over the last several years based on something that was going on. They had a bonus program in their employees, a bonus program that if a banker, if a clerk, or if a somebody that was sitting behind a telephone booth, what do you call those cubicle things that they sit in these days? It's not really a clerk anymore. He's working at the bank. They got a bonus if they could convince their customers to open up different kinds of accounts, credit cards, new types of savings accounts. And during the last 3 years, about 1.4 million accounts were made by unscrupulous employees doing something fraudulently. They created new accounts for people that didn't sign up for them. During that time, so 5,300 employees have been fired over this over that time period. But a lot of people were doing it. Obviously, if 5,300 employees got fired for it, a lot of people were creating new jobs, or not new jobs, new accounts. We're talking about 1.4 million new accounts set up. What were the damages to the people whose accounts were made in this? And this is where it gets down to where the rubber meets the road. There were $400,000 of fees charged to people that didn't sign up for the accounts. 1.4 million accounts, $400,000 of fees, 5,300 jobs gone. Okay, these are a lot of numbers. $400,000 is the one you should remember. This is where people were damaged. If you had a Wells Fargo account, somebody made a credit card for you, you didn't even know you had it, it may have had an annual charge on there of like $50 or $10 or $5. Or in some cases you got an overdraft charge because somebody set up a savings account and transferred your money without your wishes. Those overdrafts, the credit card fees, all that stuff added together and all these people to about $400,000. Okay. So, what happens next? Well, there's a big fee. Who gave the fee to Wells Fargo? Well, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did it. Richard Cordray is the director there. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was established by Dodd-Frank after the Great Recession, and it was put up to police the banks. We definitely need somebody to do that besides the Federal Reserve and to police people that are doing activities that fall outside the purview of the Federal Reserve, that fall into just somebody selling gold, buying gold fraudulently, telling people that they're never going to lose money if they buy whatever it is, and then someone loses money. Well, we need somebody whose job it was to do that. Before, it was the FBI, and the FBI had other things to do. So the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is set up. Talk about it's a bureau. It's a new bureaucrats immediately created. 5,300 employees have already been filed. There are 1.5 million deposit accounts that were not authorized, and 565,000 credit cards or accounts were created without the customer's knowledge or consent. So $400,000 is the damages so far. And it may be that that'll be more. Say, we'll call it 10 times that. Let's say it's $4 million. $4 million in damages. Well, that's not cool. People need to be paid back their money, and Wells Fargo needs to be fined for not supervising its employees. All right, so I think all of us can agree that that's a good thing, that, okay, somebody's been doing fraudulently. They're taking money from customers without their knowledge. The customers never signed up for it. Those people need to be fired, been done. And now the company that wasn't supervising well enough needs to be fined. Great, all good so far. $185 million in fines. $185 million. Now, if we say 10 times the known damages is $4 million, Wells Fargo is being fined $185 million. Okay, well, that's good. They got smacked with a big stick. They shouldn't have been doing that. We can all say, all right, they needed to be fined. $185 million, that's a lot of money for $4 million possible damages, and that's just me inflating the damages that we know about tremendously. It's a punitive thing. They shouldn't have been doing it. They need to pay for it. Well, $185 million isn't that much money to Wells Fargo. It's enough money that they recognize that it's a problem. They say, okay, we better fix this. Where'd that money go? Where'd the $185 million go? Well, first, it goes to paying back the losses to the customers. So the customers that had damages done, they get their money back. That's nice. Well, Wells Fargo's already done that. They've already been refunding those monies. So the fine hasn't gone down based on what Wells Fargo's already paid back. The fine is an important thing. It's a good thing to be punished for doing wrong. But where'd the money go? The money went to the Civil Penalty Fund, which is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's coffer of funds to pay back people that were damaged. Well, these people are already being paid back. So you got $185 million that isn't totally appropriate to be giving back to the people who were damaged. Well, what's it used for then? Well, the only other use for that fund is for ongoing educational benefits to people. There aren't that many educational programs set up on the fund. And I'm going to do a pause on this for a moment and go. It's going to sound like I'm completely changing the subject. I'm not. Trust me on this. Centuries ago, the normal way of going to war was that the soldiers were not full-time soldiers most of the time. They were called up for the war, and part of their pay was in being able to loot the people that they defeated. If you took a town, you got to go through the furniture and the jewelry and the cash that was sitting around and take it for yourself. Well, over the years, we decided that's not a good idea. That's bad. You can't really recover the economy if an American soldier is found taking a bunch of money, and this happened in the invasion of Iraq, found taking a bunch of money as loot, even if it came from the Iraq government. We have laws against that. You're not, if you're the one that's going in to knock down the government, you don't get to take the stuff that you find. Unfortunately, we haven't done that with a lot of our law enforcement. We're still operating under the same principle that was normal in warfare centuries ago, in that if a law enforcement group confiscates a bunch of money, they get to keep it. Now, they're limited in what they can use it for, but they can keep this huge amount of money, and it's certainly allowed them to be better enforcers of the law in certain areas, but it causes their priorities to be focused on areas that bring in the most revenue. This is the reason why the FBI didn't have time to chase down consumer fraud, because there was no money in it for them. Chasing down drugs and organized crime, they got to keep money in their budget that they collected. That's not the way we want our law enforcement setting their priorities. I'm not saying that they're corrupt. Don't hear that. But no matter what, if you're offered an incentive to do one thing and no incentive to do the other, even if it's your job, you're more likely to do the thing that's going to pay you more. It's just simple human nature. We don't want our priorities in law enforcement set up that way, and we certainly don't want it set up that way for fraud enforcement. If we're leveling huge penalties on Wells Fargo, they deserved it. Good job. Now let's find out some way to repatriate that back to the people that were damaged. If this were a class action lawsuit, the lawyers would get a big chunk of it, but at least the people that were damaged would get at least half of what's going on here. That is not the case with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That's something that needs to be changed. There were, and I mentioned this when Dodd-Frank came out. Anytime you make the incentive to fill up the coffers of the enforcers, then they're going to find things. The same way that Wells Fargo as a company did not say it's a great idea to make fraudulent transactions. They didn't. It was individual employees, but there were a lot of them, and they may have even been working in groups to do it. They got bonuses for it. They had incentive to do it. They broke the law to do it. They lost their jobs. The whole company's being fined. Well, who's policing the police? In this case, this isn't really a police force. Who's policing the folks that are policing the fraud? And this is before they've done anything wrong. But if they're able to collect money and hold it in their coffers to do something as vague as educational programs for finance, well, who gets paid to do those educational programs? Right now, they're using contractors. But the talk is that they're just going to set up a department that does it. That means the whole department's budget is going to be contingent upon finding fraud somewhere and finding enough money in that fraud to pay the budget for the company. Or it's not a company. We're talking about the CIA. That's how part of the CIA is funded. Funding the budget for the folks that are supposed to be enforcing the law. There are pieces here that we need to think about. If those fines are due because of wrongdoing against customers, they need to go back to the customers. If it's a big enough penalty, then the customers should get paid more money. If you feel like, if we all, and I do, I feel like $185 million is kind of a light slap on the wrist for somebody that made $23 billion last year. But it's still a lot more than the damages. That money should go back to the customers, not into the government's pockets. The government's pockets to see how they could do better. And anytime you hear a filler program that's put together about how to do your car seats for your kids or whether or not autism exists or all of, I mean, it may be actually educating people, the PSAs, public service announcements. Those are being paid for mostly with government money. They're not very effective advertisements. That government money has been allocated out to educate the public in certain areas. We're paying our tax dollars for that, and in the case of if you're a customer of Wells Fargo, some of your completely appropriate fees that were charged, that you agreed to have charged, are going towards that now, because that's where those fees are coming from. They're coming from the profits of Wells Fargo. Well, where'd they get that? From their customers. If the customers were harmed and the customers are paying the profits to Wells Fargo and Wells Fargo has to pay that to the government because the customers were harmed, there's a problem in the system. We have a break. If somebody's harmed the customers should be compensated. Okay, they're getting their losses back. If it's harm enough that we say there should be punitive damages, that is beyond just the damages that were incurred, give it back to the customers. Don't give it to the government. Now, this is me being small government. This is me being anti-big government, anti-regulation. But that's kind of the idea here. If I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican. The idea behind the law is to prevent fraud and to make sure the customer is safe. Well, the best way to show a customer that they're safe is to write them a check and say, look, we just smacked Wells Fargo. They hurt you. You get this much money back above what you were damaged because you deserve it, because somebody shouldn't lie to you. Not the government gets it because why? Why do they get it? I don't know, because the law says they get it. It doesn't make sense to me. And that's something that's not part of the debate. This sort of thing, the way we fund the executive sides of the government. And that even goes down to the local municipalities. If a police department gets to keep all of the traffic ticket money that they write, then they start devoting a lot more people to writing traffic tickets. That's something economics says happens all the time. I don't care how ethical you are. I don't care if you're really devoted to fighting crime. If you find a way to make more money so that you can fight crime, you devote more of your resources towards gathering that money. This is why we don't have a for-profit army. This is why we don't tell the army to make things to pay for what they are doing. We don't want them doing that. We want them focused on the job at hand. We should be prosecuting the law according to the way it's written. And I think a lot of Republicans agree with me on that. A lot of Democrats do too. If the law says we need to deport illegal immigrants, but no funding is given to the local governments to do that, then the local governments won't do it. If the funding is only given to the federal government, then the federal government's the one that holds the bag. Okay, if our law enforcement is about how the funding comes in, and there's another example of this in that the DEA right now is not allowed to enforce its drug laws on marijuana in states that the state has voted that medicinal marijuana is allowed. So the DEA is not allowed to do federal raids for the federal law being broken because Congress, a Republican Congress, said, hey, if they voted to do it, the local people have said to do it, if they're following the local laws, we shouldn't be having a big raid and seizing a bunch of stuff that they believe is legal, even if it's only legal statewide and not federally. I kind of agree with that. The DEA is funded in large part from its seizures. When it grabs stuff and they get the cash at the same time, that funds their next operation. If the local police department finds a meth lab, they get to keep a lot of that money. It funds their next operation, and it leads to equipment that really isn't needed because, I mean, a little municipality with an armored personnel carrier is probably not needed. The armored personnel carrier may be a much. It does make a safer approach to a SWAT raid. Don't get me wrong there. But the reality is that it's a militarization of a police force. We don't want a police state. We want the police to have the power to enforce the law and not be compensated for only enforcing some parts of the law. We need to equal the compensation out. We need to make the regulations clearer there. Because the police officers want to do their job. But if they're offered more money to do their job in one way, they're going to do it, whether that's writing tickets or just going after meth labs. I had my house broken into. This was years and years ago. But it's very difficult to follow up on a home burglary because there's no ongoing money that comes to the police department. Now, they want to solve the case, but administration gives them priorities that say, how do we bring more money into the department? This is economics. This is government. And we're about out of time. So if you'd like to contact me off the air, my phone number is 947-1111 locally. That's 947-1111. Or you can reach that toll-free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to the webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. There's podcasts. So if you weren't bored enough the first time around, you can get double bored the second. You can email me directly at jake@tpwc.com. Until next week, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach.
Fair, balanced. Your Fox News radio station in Central Texas. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.